Today's podcast is brought to you by our very first sponsor, NTK.
Woohoo!
Health IQ.
Thanks, Health IQ.
Mm-hmm. Health IQ is a new type of insurance company that gives preferential rates to healthy runners, swimmers, cyclists, triathletes, vegans.
You finally get rewarded for all the hard work that you do.
I know. It just makes too much sense. If you want to go and learn more about Health IQ, go to healthiq.com/triathlon Taryn. They have put all of the triathlon specific information there. Or if you go to the Health IQ website on your own, use the promo code triathlon Taryn at checkout or when you're speaking with a representative to get potentially up to a 25% savings on your life insurance. Today's podcast guest is Jerry Rodriguez.
I am naming him potentially the best guest we've ever had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kim, or Kimmy, as he called her as we were signing off, is a very big fan of Jerry. And in this interview, we talk about a lot of very tactical things with swimming. Like what in doing the research on Jerry over the past week, what I really liked about him and the shows in today's interview is that he is able to break down the complications of swimming with something as simple as like do vertical kicking and think about how tall you feel. And little tiny nuggets like that are basically in this hour that we chatted with him. He just nailed it right out of the park. Like,
I feel anybody who listens to this will walk away with something they can actually use.
And a chuckle.
He's just a great guy.
Good guy.
Big fan.
Anything else?
Nope. Let's just go do it.
Let's get into the podcast. Let's do it. Let's get going here. We have Jerry Rodriguez from Tower 26, a very well-known triathlon swim coach. I think most recently your special project has been Lionel Sanders, who has obviously been
a name a few people might have heard,
and definitely a name a few people might have heard as far as it goes with improving one's swimming. And he's looked to you as, I don't know exactly what he's called you, but something like the guru of swimming, the best guy in the sport. So very high accolades here for you, Jerry. And thank you for taking the time to be on the podcast. Let's take it back to when it all started. Like you started swimming at the ripe young age of 7. Tell us how that all came about.
Well, firstly, thanks for having me on. And yes, I did start swimming as a little kid and grew up in the Caribbean. And my dad took me to the local YMCA, and that's where it all started. And enjoyed doing it, and I've been doing it since. And that puts us at almost 48 years now.
See, I would think in the Caribbean, you wouldn't need to go to a pool. There's a little bit of ocean around you. You'd just hop on in.
Interesting, huh? You would think, but it's so funny. Folks that live on islands, you take those things for granted.
I heard something once that people in Trinidad, specifically like 10% only can actually swim.
You know, that's the first that I'm hearing that statistic, but I wouldn't be surprised. Again, you know, sort of third world country type thing, that there's just not a lot of exposure to activities such as swimming or tennis or whatever it may be. So it's just there are a few swim clubs for kids, and my dad happened to get me involved in one of them.
So how did the competition aspect of it come around then if it wasn't a big part of the culture?
Well, I think once you join a swim program, just as you would in Canada or in the United States, sort of the normal progression is you start, once you've learned to swim and get involved in their training sessions, so to speak, and then the natural progression is you start swimming age group swim meets. So whatever age you are at that time, that would be the normal thing to do. So I was a little kid, so I started in the 7 to 8 age group, and then you go up to the 9 to 10 age group as you get older and so on, and you just run through all the age groups.
And then I understand,
until they kick you out or you leave.
Well, I understand that at age 10, you had a goal. You set a goal of winning an Olympic medal after watching Mark Spitz win Olympic gold. And then you didn't ever end up making an Olympic team, but you did coach Spitz 20 some odd years later.
Oh, God. You know, you talk about setting your North Star and falling real short of it to bring that up.
Could you at least grow a mustache like Spitz could? Like, that's at least attainable for mere mortals.
Oh, gosh, you know, it was the 1972 Olympics, and I was just obviously a little kid, and I remember setting my alarm to wake up early in the morning, and I went outside so my parents wouldn't know, and turned on the radio. And back then we had these big old, they were called stereograms back then. And you just sort of put your ear against the speaker, and I tuned into the radio station and sat there, crouched up at 3 a.m. listening to him race, and said, I want to be like that guy one day. So that was, 1972 summertime.
Amazing that it came full circle, though, that you ultimately did end up coaching him later on. I mean, that's kind of, although you joke about setting the North Star goal of the Olympics, I mean, that's pretty darn lofty to be coaching a guy like Mark Spitz.
Well, Mark had wrapped up his career, and then I eventually came to the United States in 1980, went to college, and then started coaching. And a number of years later, I was running a master's swimming program at UCLA, and Mark lived in the neighborhood in Beverly Hills. And he joined our program. So I ended up being his coach for a number of years.
That had to be pretty cool for you. Like, little 10-year-old you have been pretty excited.
Oh, sure. Here's your hero. And he shows up in your program. We'd met, a few years before that. But absolutely. I mean, you're having a name in the sport prior to Michael Phelps hadn't risen yet. And Mark Spitz was the icon of swimming at that point. So, of course, absolutely.
At that point, with him being your idol for decades, and how many gold medals did he accumulate over the course of his career? I mean, I lost track. But what can you, former person that was looking up to the guy as a 10-year-old kid, like, how do you approach coaching a guy like that?
Well, I think many folks like Mark that swam at the very elite level or at the pointy end that come back into swimming, they're there for the comradeship, enjoyment, exercise, and fitness. It's not really about being coached. I think it's more about getting some exercise so they can eat whatever ice cream you want that night.
That's why people swim, then I'm taking up swimming.
So, I think they still have to fall within the guidelines and the philosophy of the program, but for the most part, they're there for different purposes.
So you ended up going all the way through the college ranks, right, with Pepperdine. Did you have a scholarship with them?
I had an athletic scholarship, yes, but I was one of those very mediocre swimmers at best. So you talk about falling way short of that North Star. I was just a very basic sort of utility swimmer that was sort of the jack of all trades, master of nothing. And I can swim a decent 50 or 100 freestyle, but also swim a mile and swim some butterfly and swim a little bit of IM, individual medley, which is all the different strokes. So nothing by any means outstanding whatsoever. In fact, I would say I was probably very good at being average at best.
What's it like going through that as a young, I'm guessing you're about 19, 20 at this age, and for quick math, call it 12 or 13 years, your life had been focused on swimming, and all of a sudden you're having to come to grips with growing up and becoming an adult, but B, realizing that the future that you thought you were going for isn't within your grasp.
Well, it's the, as a little kid, you set that goal and you want to go become the best in the world. And for me, it meant leaving Trinidad when I just turned 17, and I left to go to college, and my college career was done by 20. And now it's, what do I do? I mean, you've fallen way short of your goal, and it's trying to figure out what the backside of the journey is going to be. Fortunately for me, I was Trinidad. I raced a fair amount of open water races and trained 3 or 4 months a year in open water. So I had a reasonably extensive background, at least leading up to then. So I started open water racing at the age of 20 or 21 and then continued that throughout my career. So I still had this other thing that held another North Star, so to speak, that kept me motivated and kept me fit.
What did the goals turn into at that point?
I think I just wanted to win. I just wanted to go to races and win them. I mean, it was about being the best that I could be and winning. Nothing short of that. Of course, I was used to setting lofty goals.
But I mean, we talk about these.
And obviously a miraculous failure at some of those, but all joking aside, I mean, it was just about doing as well as I could do. Given you got to think, you're a third world country, you move to the United States, everything's big, everyone's fast, and just the mere fact that I'm now swimming against some of the best athletes in the world was pretty inspiring to me.
But I mean, you know, we joke about mediocrity and whatnot, but you did have some impressive accomplishments. You participated on numerous Trinidad national teams. You know, you took trips to a number of countries. You hold some Masters national titles, a few World Masters titles, some national World Masters records. You did a 28.5-mile swim around Manhattan Island. So you didn't accomplish nothing. I mean, it wasn't all mediocre.
Well, sort of self-deprecated a little bit. But yes, when I do something, I fully invest. And I committed myself to that and to the process of really learning that sport really well. And in fact, there wasn't much to learn because there was sort of not much education available about open water racing and open water training. So I started creating it. And, you know, when I would lose races, I'd go sort of make a journal as to why. What happened in this race? Why did that guy do that? Or why did I not respond to something? And I started coming up with lots and lots of rules or guidelines to follow in racing. And then I backed into how do I now train for that? So I self-crafted all my training sessions to be able to accomplish what it would take to attain those victories. And then the swim around Manhattan, it was just that sort of, again, one of those things that I thought, that's kind of a crazy thing to do. Let me try and do that.
Yeah, that's a good bucket list one. How long did that take?
That was 8 hours and 2 minutes. And it was one of those other things that I thought, you know, I'm going to go win this thing. And that didn't happen either.
8 hours and 2 minutes. You know, that's incredibly fast. Is that close to the top? Because we did this past summer, we did a 37K current assisted. So we're talking about 23 miles. And that was, one of us finished in 8:18. I was just over 9, but that was some serious current that was helping us.
Wow, congratulations. Yeah, that's tremendous. Yeah. Well, it's more tremendous. You're not a kid like I was then. So you've, that's really outstanding. For swimming around Manhattan, they're current. So you're going to be assisted at certain times. And then there were times that I was at least, in a negative current. And that particular event, you have to time the currents really well, which I didn't do. So that was to my demise. Doesn't help very much because I was too fast too soon at the first 15 miles of the race and then was trapped for about an hour stationary at one portion during the race. The winner was like 20 minutes faster, actually. So they were quite far ahead.
Was that a PAX
one? It was a lovely sight when they passed me. What was that? I'm sorry?
You say when they passed me. So I assume it was a PAX swim? Like there were PAX tactics going on?
I recall 3 or 4 people passing throughout probably a 1 hour frame, but it wasn't a pack. Everyone was pretty strung out. But I would see them passing. One person was fairly close by and others were fairly lateral. But at that point I was completely bunked because my wonderful crew and I forgot our food. So I had no fuel the entire race. I mean, I started off at 7 a.m. and there was nothing for 8 hours.
Oh my God.
Where did you forget it? Like on the kitchen table?
Extraordinary experience. I'm sorry?
Where did you forget it? Was it just sitting on the kitchen table?
I think it was left on the dock and you have to have a boat and we just didn't have anything.
No.
And we had a thermos that had some fuel in it, a drink like sea back then. But anyway, you talk about making just about every mistake possible. We made it.
Well, we're getting wildly off topic, but this is kind of a funny story that, so there were 3 of us that tried the 37K swim. 2 of us finished. The 3rd person, he had hypothermia, had to pull out. Couple months later, he decides that he's going to reattempt by himself solo. But I said, you know what, I'll help you and I'll be in a canoe alongside of you. Well, at hour 3, he starts throwing up, pushes through it and threw up for about 2 hours. But then from hours 5 to 12, because by that time in the year, there was no current whatsoever. For 7 hours, it was like I was playing like, open your mouth, Pat, and like, here comes the airplane. We got to feed you.
Yeah.
And he would turn his face like, no, I don't want it. No, I don't. And I ate more in the canoe than he ate swimming for 12 hours because he just couldn't get any food in him.
Those, you know, that happens obviously in even riding and especially in running and triathlon. But in swimming, because it's a little more dynamic, you're in the water. There's just something about not discomfort of wanting to eat while swimming. And in my case, obviously not having anything, although my crew did beg of the boat captain to share a little bit of his lunch. So I did get, the full disclosure, a half a peach That was my entire fuel.
How generous of him.
So there were all sorts of stories about, yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's fantastic. Can we go back to when you were, say, writing down what was going on in the open water swims and you were trying to figure out what you needed to figure out? Can you describe the thought process of going through, all right, this race happened this way, and throwing away the things that you couldn't take away from it? Like, how did you decide what you needed to decide? Because I mean, that's something that age groupers right now have to sift through. Here's the good stuff that I need to listen to. Here's the stuff that I don't. How did you wade through that?
Well, at that point, there was nothing to listen to. So that's the good news. You had to create. And given that I had raced a fair amount and trained a fair amount in open water as a kid, so from 11 through 16, for those years, I was 3 or 4 months a year, 3 or 4 times a week. Our coach took us to open water and we did open water training. Had a fair amount of experience, obviously, on the training aspect, but back then it was very rudimentary, basically swim from point A to point B and back. There was nothing more sophisticated than that, which is good for about 3 sessions or 5 sessions. There's adaptation, and then what else do you do? But we didn't know any better. That's all we did. Once I moved here and started racing and was winning initially, and then you get into more competitive fields, and I would lose a race or two here or there, I would start analyzing, well, why did that happen? And once I learned some of the things that occurred, then it was a matter of, you know, trying to manage the chessboard, so to speak, because it's such a dynamic environment. And you got to think, as a kid in a swim team, swimming in a pool event, you're just up and down the black line for 2 times if it's a 100-meter freestyle, 4 times if it's a 200-meter freestyle, 8 times if it's an 800 water break. Maybe a very static environment. That there's really not much else other than swimming as fast as you can. Or as managing your effort as best as you can between two walls. Here you've got a highly dynamic environment. You've got a wide breadth of space to swim in. There are lots of tactical things you can do or need to be aware of. So I just started trying to figure what those things were. And because I'm pretty analytical in the sense of wanting to, and also have a pretty heavy appetite for wanting to learn how to do things and do them well. So I just started making up rules. In fact, one of the most important rules I came up with that helped me quite a bit, because I'd lost a race, and this was in 1980, I think it was 89 or 1990. I was doing an event that I had won the prior year, and it was a 2-mile open water race. And after the start, there were about 10 of us that broke away, and it was a very, very fast start. And I would say that we probably went through the first 400 meters in the pace felt to be about probably 104, 105 hundred meter pace. So, and for those in the United States, that's a 56 second 100 yard pace. And it was quite quick. And we were all strung out in a line, one behind each other. So first person, then a second person, one body length back on their feet, third person, one body length, and so on. And there are 9 or 10 of us. And I was about fifth in that line. And what happened was the leader, who I knew, a guy that I raced in college with, was on the Pernine swim team with me. The leader broke away, or framed differently, the second person wasn't able to keep contact with the feet of the leader. So a little gap occurred between the first and the second person. Once I noticed that, which, and you got to think, since we have less opportunity for visual feedback in swimming, because much of the time your head's in the water, and then you're sighting less frequently. It's not like running or riding. If you see a gap occur, you're going to see it pretty almost instantly. In swimming, it takes a little bit longer to get that data point. Once I realized that occurred, I had to swim around the guy in fourth place, rest for a second, sit on the feet of the guy in third place, swim around him, rest for a second, swim around the next guy, and get all the way up to that second place position. And that 10 meters or so that I was behind, because remember, I was in fifth place, that 10-meter gap just stayed the same 10 meters the rest of the way. I could not close it for the next mile and three quarters. And I was so pissed. I got done with the race, congratulated Paul, was his name, and was happy for him. But I thought, you know, what happened here? And obviously what happened was, once a gap occurs, if you're not in a position to react to it or in the right place, you're typically dropped, unless you're much faster than the person who created the gap, or the leader in this case. And we were about the same swim speed, so I never was able to close the gap. Therefore came the one body length rule. And from every race there forward, I never allowed more than one body length to occur in any race. I would always be towards the front or right on the leader's feet, but try to never be further back from that if possible. So there's an example of one rule. And because of that rule, I obviously, therefore, went ahead to win many, many races, because if that leader made that big surge, I was right there to react to it quicker or try to draft or whatever it may be.
Is this something that still applies in triathlon?
Well, it's something that I teach our triathletes, certainly in positions that they want. If they're in a pack position, they want to get up to that, let's say in a pack of 4 or 5 or 8 or 10, you want to be towards the front of your pack, whatever pack you're in, whether you're in the elite pack, if you're the elite group, or you're, you know, your little bubble of a handful of people, even if you're 20 minutes back, you want to be towards the front of that pack, yes.
So at what point do you start taking all of these findings that you're putting together and switching from being the swimmer to coaching swimmers?
Well, I started coaching immediately my last year of college. And in fact, triathlon was now getting started. And this is the, well, it started a few years before, but this was sort of in the budding years. This is the very early 80s. And a couple of friends that were, one that was a college student at Pepperdine and another who was just moved into the city, into Malibu. And he started racing and they both asked me to coach them. And that was sort of the beginning of my coaching. It started with triathletes, and fast forward, here I am today, and that's all I do.
Slight pause in the interview here, Trainiacs, just to thank our sponsor for today, Health IQ, the life insurance agency that gives preferential rates to triathletes, swimmers, cyclists, healthy people.
You get rewarded for taking care of yourself, which is kind of amazing because that's never happened before. So you want to take advantage of this?
Mm-hmm. You go to healthiq.com/triathlon Taryn. That's where all the triathlon specific information is. Or if you just go to Health IQ's website on your own, you can type in the code triathlon Taryn at checkout, or when you're talking with a representative, and all those things help Health IQ know just how awesome we are. Lets them know that you came from us, and it helps out the podcast.
So thanks to you and Health IQ.
Back to the podcast. Yeah, let's fast forward to today and bring people up to speed on what Tower 26 is. I know from the website what you do. I know that Tower 26 was the lifeguard tower that you originally met at for one of the open water swims. But give us the 25,000 foot view of what your philosophy is and what the offerings are that you give to triathletes.
Well, once I, you know, as I coached master swimming for many, many years and also helped coach many elite swimmers and so on. And the key thing that was missing for me as a coach, if I could sort of make it about myself rather than about the athlete for a moment, is that although I enjoyed coaching master swimming, not every master swimmer competed. And I always wanted them to compete or to do something that mapped their progress, because that gave me feedback as to how I was doing as a coach. So many didn't. So I was always sort of, athletes to events, and obviously many would go, but many wouldn't go because most master swimmers don't compete. So I finally started up an all triathlon program because I realized, you know what? Who competes? Every single triathlete competes. That's their thing. That's they're in a race. And it became really easy for me to map progress, and I like having goals. So when I created Tower 26, it was a program exclusively for triathletes. Now, we do have a handful of folks that don't compete in triathlon, but for the most part, in the high 90 percentile are triathletes. We had pool workouts, but we created an open water session that happened to be at that particular location. And I just named the group Tower 26 because we met at a lifeguard tower, 26. And we have that one session a week that's coached at that location. It's a Wednesday. It's a middle of the week session prior to work. And we do that for about 6 months a year during the racing season. So for us in Southern California, it starts around April, May, and I'll go until right after the Kona Ironman. And we run 24 workouts. And then that gets augmented, obviously, with pool sessions. So the year-round person that's training for this would then be doing all our pool workouts the rest of the season. And then in the summertime or in racing season, they would augment that with the additional one open water session, at least one. And that would be for sort of age group athletes, pro athletes that move to come swim in our program. I would have them do more training sessions because they need the additional injection.
But I read that you get, for those Wednesday morning sessions, between 100 and 300 people showing up to every session. I mean, that is a lot of people who want that training.
This is the size of one of our large triathlons here where we're from.
Yeah, that's a whole race, right?
Well, it's funny. That's it. Back when I started going to triathlons, that was the size of an entire race, a couple hundred athletes. Yes, we get a pretty large group. You have to recall, I've been doing this for a very, very long time. So people sort of know who you are, and the session itself is fairly robust in its structure. It's a challenging session. And if you think about the personality of the triathlete, they're very driven and so on. So they tend to gravitate to sessions like this that are demanding and challenging. So it's grown, and there are at least 100 people each session. It has grown to over 300, but I had to put a cap on it because sort of any Johnny-come-lately wanted to show up 2 weeks before their local triathlon with no training and hop into the session because they heard, here's the thing to come to. And that's not good from a safety perspective and from a management perspective for me, trying to make the experience, you know, profitable to everybody. So we have sort of guidelines that you have to achieve to be able to come into those workouts now. So I cap the workouts at a certain number.
Mm. What is that
and
workout?
Then we break it up into various groups too. I mean, you come to that session, there may be 150 to 250 people, but it's also subcategory. So your elite athletes, your Lionels of the world, as an example, since you brought that name up earlier, that would be your, they'd be in their subcategory of group one. Then group two would be your 28-minute to 33-minute half Ironman athletes, and group three would be 33-minute to 37-minute athletes, and then 37-40, and so on. So it's all based on speed and ability.
And what does the workout look like?
A typical workout would have anywhere from 10 to 15 minutes of easy warm-up, and then we have buoys that we set, specifically designed course that I would set up each week, and a course length could range from 300 or 400 meters to 800 meters, and we would do multiple circuits. So a very intense session could be 8 or 9 for 2 or 3 minutes rest in between, with each circuit having a particular demand to it, whether that's more of a takeout speed, whether it's more of a drafting focus, whether it's more of high siding, whatever it may be. There are different instructions for various circuits. And then they would swim the circuit, exit the water, and then jog back to the start point. So which also practices, obviously at the beginning, race starts, navigation, drafting, race exits, running to transition, an example, and which would be the run back to the start point. So all the pieces that occur on race day is built into just one circuit, and we're doing multiple circuits. And then think about this, we're doing this for 24 sessions. So anyone who comes to these sessions are usually highly prepared to, you know, be able to have the best experience they could from the perspective of their swim portion of their triathlon would be very process driven. And they're highly skilled and well prepared to do well, well being the best that they can be.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of like how some people design a brick workout with a bike and run, and there's multiple times they're going back and forth because they want to get that snap of the feeling going from the bike to the run as many times as possible. It's not about doing a 1 hour bike and then a 30 minute run. It's about literally that first minute when you're running and how that feeling happens in your legs and getting the cement out of them as quick as possible.
Well, think about it. How many times, or if you sort of look at, if there was such a thing, the average athlete, the average triathlete, you'd go to the pool, you'd swim 1 or 2 or 3 times a week, you swim 30 minutes to an hour, and then you show up on event day. And you've either never swam in open water, or if you have, it's just sort of a point to point, like I did as a little kid, and or you've not practiced any siding, you've not done anything to mimic or become adapted to exiting the water and running to the transition. So your heart rate just blows up the moment you stand up and start running the transition.
Yep.
All of these things that occur on race day, well, why not build those into your training sessions? So those are all built into our pool sessions first. And then the open water session augments that from the perspective of you're in the environment. That's the only difference. But all the siding, the skill building, the race takeout speed, all the things that occur in your triathlon race, we do those in our pool workouts at that time of the season. So every single pool workout, in fact, has siding, as an example, built into it, has race takeout effort built into it. We do something called deck ups, where you complete a particular distance and then you have to climb out and jog for 10 seconds.
Oh, you're evil. So
all the skills. Well, but guess what happens in race day?
They're prepared for it.
You're completely fresh. So the swim is removed from the equation of having any tax on your system.
Mm-hmm. At a minimum, how much would you say a average triathlete who isn't part of your program should be trying to get into open water. Let's assume that they are very beginner, probably don't have a ton of access to open water and might be afraid of it. Like we're talking beginner of beginner. What would be a minimum amount of times that they should be trying to get into open water before one of their first couple races?
Well, let's back that question up and sort of go a more large frame, if I may, if I have that liberty.
No, absolutely not. And answer my question. I want a number and then we're moving on here, Jerry.
And just sort of say, well, wait a minute, what are we trying to achieve here? Well, I want to finish this race and I want to finish it with some amount of comfort, okay? And not be, you know, say that's the last time, that's the first and only time I'm ever going to do a triathlon because it was just too difficult. So what they should do is build in a number of the demands into their pool training sessions. That's actually the first thing that should occur. So in their pool training, some of the things we just talked about should be built in. Then if they have the opportunity to get into open water, the body, my experience in coaching, depending on one's aptitude. So highly athletic people have a little quicker adaptation, less athletic people a little bit longer. But typically it takes about 10 times to become very adapted to something. Okay? Somebody that's super high adaptation ability, it's 5 or 6 times, like very elite athletes. And then others, it could be 9 or 10 or 12 times. But typically 10 is a good number. So if you can get a handful, 2 handfuls in this case, 10 sessions in before your race, that's sort of the perfect world. But even if you got 3 sessions in only, but you sprinkled in all the demands, all those ingredients into your pool training sessions, that's plenty fine. Providing you're not looking to win your age group, as an example. If you're just the athlete you laid out, I'm just, you know, Joe, Jenny average, and I'm going to do my first triathlon. Well, why not find some program or some coach locally or online that knows their thing and do the right swimming pool preparation program, and then do your 2 or 3 sessions, open water sessions, where you get to practice those skills that you learned in the pool, and then you're ready for event day. Mm-hmm. And that's very rudimentary. That would be the basic baseline. We, of course, do something much more robust than that, but that would sort of be a minimum standard from my perspective.
Now, on your website, you do say that one-size-fits-all coaching doesn't work, at least it doesn't work for you. You know, how do you do that modification then, especially when you've got like 300 people showing up at once? How do you approach that?
Well, we take a certain standard to begin with. So the person showing up at the beach to our sessions has typically swam in our pool workouts. So they're already starting at a slightly higher level, if we want to use that word, a little bit more experience and more sophistication. We've already initiated, or they've already been initiated with a number of skills. They've sort of been baptized already in our pool sessions for sighting and a number of the skills you'd want to acquire. So once they get to open water, they're a little bit more available to, you know, deploy those skills.
Can I interrupt and say, what are the first bits of coaching that you say are part of your philosophy? I know today I was practicing your tautness, which I love, by the way. You've got some good drills. Do you want to kind of explain?
Explain tautness for those of us who have no clue what you're talking about.
Explain the coaching philosophy that you start with and tautness in particular. I love the word.
So you rolled from open water there into sort of specific pool stuff. So let's, I'll segue in. I try to take swimming, which I think can be, if one wants to make it, a very complex topic because you can listen to 10 different coaches and get different things to do, okay? Or you could read some coaching book that was written by the name of the who's who of swimming coaches, and it can be very, very complicated. And my job as a teacher, as an instructor, as a coach, is to, I think, take what can be a complex topic and simplify it and have you able to, at a minimum, understand it in its simplicity, and then give you some very basic things to focus on to build your skill. So one of them you talked about, that you mentioned, is tautness. And tautness, is said differently, would be proper body posture. So when we run with an erect posture. We don't slouch over. You know, you're not down crawling, you're standing up. You have a very slight lean forward.
You have nice and tall.
Terrific posture. Nice and tall, exactly. So the word I just use is taut. And we want to have that tautness in the pool. Now, the reason that becomes important in the pool is this, if I may ask, what do you weigh?
157.
157. Go into the water, those 157 pounds, much of it is displaced. So the 157 pound person weighs approximately 92% less. Okay. So now you're down to this heavily subsidized weight. And in fact, if we put your heavily subsidized weight, if we made you weigh just 12 pounds on land and I asked you to walk or run or do anything, you probably couldn't do it very well because you're not adapted to that weight. And in fact, you're very used to your weight and you're very used to having gravity placed upon you. And all of your motor skills, your proprioception is based on that weight in an environment with gravity. When you're in the pool, the weight's displaced and gravity is somewhat taken away. You're in somewhat of this suspended medium. So the motor skill that you've developed on land, they don't apply any longer in the water. In fact, we don't really know what to do with our bodies because when a coach asks you to do something, why doesn't somebody do it very easily in the pool? Whereas if they asked you, go ahead and take your finger and touch your nose on land, well, you can do that pretty easily. Go ahead and, you know, make circles with your fists around each other. You can do that pretty easily on land, but we ask you to do that in the water and it's much more difficult to do. So that awareness of what our body is doing or trying to do is challenging because we haven't spent time in that medium and you have a new weight, it's suspended. And for triathletes, and this is where swimming is much more difficult for triathletes, you're in a very, very dynamic environment. Open water, relative to all those pool swimmers you see at the Olympic Games, they're in that nice, big, juicy, fixed tank with big, fat lane lines at a set temperature water, and everyone's got their own lane. So the world is very different for triathletes. So we start with the foundation, which is building proper hotness and learning what that means, how to hold your body really well in the water. Because it's easy. If you just went by to a swimming pool and you looked at any lap swimmer swim, that's not a competitor, not wanting to do a triathlon, but they're just lap swimming back and forth for exercise. Most of them are scrunchy looking. Their bodies are all twisted up. If you really sat and observed them, they look like they're about a foot shorter than they are when they're standing up. So a 6 foot person would look 5 feet tall. A 5.5 foot person looks 4.5 feet. They look like miniature versions of themselves typically. Generally, not very good swimming form that's very sloppy and very crooked and very twisted and so on. That all starts with improper posture.
Yeah, something
so that's the foundation.
Something that I did this afternoon, actually, as I listened to your podcast about tautness, which people should go check out, the Be Race Ready podcast by Tower 26, phenomenal. I compared footage of a really good swimmer in our lane who's about 6 feet tall, about 4 inches taller than me. Mm-hmm. Side by side mm-hmm. with footage of me swimming, 5'8", and I could see that his entire reach on a side profile was probably about 12 to 14 inches longer than my entire side profile. And I could look at his legs were stretched out long, his body was elongated, his front arm was out as far as it could be, and it was like 12 to 14 inches longer. And I'm going, he doesn't have that much bigger a wingspan than I am. And it all kind of made sense. Like he goes across the water like a log that you're pushing down a river. I go across the water like a pool noodle that flops in there and doesn't move.
And that's a good word, but a pool noodle, because that's exactly, we haven't quite learned how to hold our bodies really well in the water. So that's the base. That's the foundation. That's the, you know, the backbone of proper swimming. And then we just layer on things on top of that. But we have to start with that. So that is principle number one. And then we layer on something called alignment. And then we go to propulsion and so on. So we have sort of these base building steps.
So Taryn, then how did practicing tautness feel? Was it hard?
It was challenging on my muscles. It's like doing a stomach activation, like a half crunch almost. Just enough to feel the solar plexus and the side of the muscles for an hour straight instead of being sloppy and loose.
So that's the first thing that goes when you're fatigued is the ability to hold yourself firmly in the water. So you need, and to your words, you need actually the right amount of tension. How much tension do I need to put into my muscles to keep my body like that guy that you described that was 14 inches longer to hold my body really well? And that requires, you know, experience. Or time in the water. You just have to do it a lot of times. But being able to have that correct body posture requires complete and dedicated mindfulness in every single session. And especially for the triathlete, it is a absolute dedicated focus. Why? you only have 2 or 3 hours a week if you're spending that much relative to that guy you were talking about, or earlier discussion, Mark Spitz or Michael Phelps. Those guys spent 20 to 25 to 30 hours a week swimming in a pool for multiple years. You've got maybe 2 hours a week. If you only have two, you've got to make it highly dedicated and focused if you want to yield the best return for your time.
Yeah, the way that we could talk about this for the entire podcast, and you did in yours. So I'll link it up in the show notes and people can go and listen to it because you explain it much better. What is some of the worst advice that you hear commonly given about triathlon swimming?
I don't know if there's worst advice. You got to think every coach that's giving advice, he or she is giving the best knowledge that they have acquired in their careers as athletes or as coaches. The question I think we have to ask, is that advice appropriate for this particular audience? And for me, I break down the audiences for swimming at least into four categories. You got your lap swimmer. You've got your competitive pool swimmer, Michael Phelps, Mark Spitz. You have your competitive open water swimmer. And then you have your triathlete. There would be crossover in education for some of those four categories. And then there would be things that would not apply to one category that would apply to another. So, and let's make a very obvious one, which, and this doesn't occur, but teaching a triathlete how to dive would not be very important unless they're an ITU athlete diving off the pontoon. But diving wouldn't be a skill. It wouldn't be something you need in your repertoire of skills, since most races start on land or start in the water. So there are many other things, such as diving, that coaches would ask or demand upon their athletes or encourage their athletes to learn to do that really don't apply for the triathlete. Example, how you would coach Usain Bolt, the world's fastest 100-meter runner, technically at least, how you would coach him, and also from a training perspective, the prescription of training you would give him to do, from training workout protocols and the key technical things to focus on, would not be the same that you would give to the guy that's running the marathon. Could we agree on that?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Well,
clearly.
It's an entirely different athlete.
Yeah.
Exactly. But what we have are times our coaches giving advice as if it's a very blanket thing to give for the triathlete to do. They only need a specific set of things to do and do them to do it really well. And some things they don't need to learn how to do. So we got to learn what are those things. And then remembering that they only have a couple hours a week. How much do we need to give them? And what are the things that they need to get down really, really well to make them a reasonably good swimmer? We're not trying to turn them into Mark Spitz or Michael Phelps. We're trying to make them the best they could be in 2 hours a week of swimming, or maybe 3 hours for some that are a little more dedicated.
Like the minimum effective dose, essentially?
Right. What is the minimum effective dose that can yield the best return? And what is the proper swimming mechanics that person should be working on? And that's going to vary. You know, some coaches will have different opinions on it. Mine are just mine developed over 35 years of doing this.
I want to switch gears here and chat a little bit about Lionel Sanders for a couple of reasons. A, because we're Canadians and we are big fans of Lionel. B, because I think he has a similar journey and similar aspirations, well, times about 10 or 100, as the average swimmer. He came from a running background, not a swimming background, like most triathletes. He's not one of the ITU superstars that grew up swimming since they were 7 years old. And he wanted to make big improvements in swimming, came and hired you. How did that all come about? Like, what were the first few workouts like with Lionel?
So I went and did a lot of homework on Lionel and looked at all his race results and so on. And then we spent hours on the phone chatting because I need to build, for someone like him, I got to quickly build an athletic profile and understand the psyche, see some footage swimming. You need to take in a lot of data points before you can try to develop anything for, in this case, Lionel. And what I eventually ended up doing was I came out to Canada and spent some time with him for several days. You know, that was several months in, but being able to see him swim and swim with him and spend a lot more time, that was super helpful. But for where he was at that time, you just sort of have to take that information and decide what's going to be best for him going forward. Specifically with Lionel, which I think applies, by the way, to many triathletes, they're in this sort of solo cave where they tend to swim alone a lot, get their hands on as much reading material or video material that they could, and do a lot of self-analysis, and then go out and maybe pull in a whole bunch of different coaches, and then get clouded with a whole bunch of different opinions on what they should do. And I think that's sort of the norm, and Lionel had some of that. And coming in, so he had all these different ideas of how to do things and ideas of what he didn't want to do based on some things he'd done. And it was just a matter of sort of getting him to recognize there's only a handful of things you really need to do. So put some dedicated focus on that and get to task. And he is very good at, you know, being obviously completely focused. So he went to work on it. And then Lionel and I didn't do a whole lot of work in this year, which ironically, he improved the most.
There's a feather in your cap.
But one of the things that Lionel was told to do, which he didn't do initially when we were working together, was go join the kids' swim team. He needs to go swim with a bunch of people, kids that are faster than him. And for some reason, he had some little bit of resistance to that for a while, but he eventually did that this year. And that helped make some pretty big improvements. And you have somebody there giving you feedback consistently, you know, whatever, 2,500 miles away. I'm not his best investment. He needs somebody local. And he was told that from the very beginning. You need somebody local that's your on-site, location-based person to help you out. And in his case specifically, the very first conversation we ever had, he made a statement, and many others make the same statement, and I told him you have to remove that from his thinking and his vocabulary. He started off with, I'm a shitty swimmer. And I said, Lionel, you're swimming 28 minutes for half Ironman. I think 98% of other triathletes would give their right arm to swim 28 minutes. So you're not a shitty swimmer. So you have to remove that thinking and that mindset and change that to, I'm a developing swimmer, or I'm progressing towards my goal. We got to change the words that you tell yourself and make the focus more positive rather than having it on the negative. And of course, the media likes to, every time they would write about Lionel, they'd write about his crappy swim. So that gets in, you know, the negative side of it gets enforced often if you start reading your clippings too much.
Well, you know, he was already that good a swimmer that you had to give him that advice and say what you said. You know, you're better than 98% of the people out there. People would give their right arm to be like that. Yet you're sending him to swim with kids. Can you get into that a little bit more deeply? Because I've heard of other people doing that because Lionel is doing it as sort of a technique for training. But can you explain the mindset behind that and exactly what doing that would give someone who is already as good as him at that point?
Well, he's good in the triathlon space. But the triathlon space is relatively slow compared to the real swimming world of competitive swimming. So there's a bunch of 11 and 12-year-old girls that can swim that fast. So whether it's 11 and 12-year-old girls or boys, or an environment that has lots of people that are faster than him, so he can be carried along with a training program that's reasonably robust and with a coach that can give some feedback, technical feedback, all of those ingredients will help that type of athlete. So it just so happens that at the level that he was at, 28 minutes or so for half Ironman, as with many other pros that I've coached or even elite age groupers, if there's not a master's program close by and or one that has the specific things that you need, you then have to try to get on an age group team, a little kids team, if the coach will allow you, and swim with them, because there are four things you need to become a better triathlon swimmer. And this is in no particular order. You need better swimming mechanics. Typically, most need much higher training volume than they do. You need the proper swimming prescription. What are the proper swim workouts you need to do rather than just going to swim? And then you need some form of accountability. Okay? So those four things, many of them get dealt with in a competitive swim program, such as 11, 12-year-old girls or boys or 13-year-old or whatever the age might be. So put yourself in that environment to be able to meet those criteria.
Over the years, you've coached, we were talking about Lionel here, you mentioned Mark Spitz, over the last few years, Holly Lawrence, Jesse Thomas. These are some really big names in the swimming and triathlon world. Do you have a particular favorite story from any of them?
Favorite stories? You know, everyone's so unique in their own way, and you have such interesting experiences with everybody. It's all personality driven. I mean, you pull little, there's nothing coming immediately. I'll think on that. I'll ponder on that while we talk some more, but I'm sure something will come up.
So, I mean, you've coached some of those big names, as he just mentioned. Are you most proud of that? Or what are some of the other accolades in your career that you are most proud of? Is it things that maybe aren't as obvious as some of the big famous names?
I think I'm gifted and fortunate to have an incredible ability to be very focused. And because of that, and I don't think it's just a gift, it's practice. When I coach workouts, I can coach a workout of 30, 40, 50 people, which I do. And I can stop a workout at any time. In fact, I can give a swim set. Let's say we give a 1,000. Everyone's going to swim. Let's make it 10 minutes. Everyone's going to finish at the same time. A 10-minute swim. In those 10 minutes, I can stop. Well, let's make it even a little more interesting for this conversation. Let's make it 10 times 100, okay? 10 times 100 at 80% effort with 15 seconds rest between each 100. I can stop that workout at 100 number 6 or 7 or 8 and ask people, or even after the 10 100s, what were your times on every single 100? What was your stroke count or your stroke rate? Certain specific things I can ask. And many don't know it. But of all 50 people, I can tell you what their times were on every single 100, what their stroke count was and their stroke rate was, as an example. So all these little details get stored in my wacky brain that I have that can accumulate a lot of information and remember it for everybody. So it's probably a little skill that I've acquired over the years. And I can be able to see you swimming 150 meters away in open water, and I can pick out your swim stroke amounts to 100 people. So I have these sort of little, you know, Rain Man nuances about me, I guess, that sort of...
That's incredible.
Strange that way.
But no, you think about it.
I can't even remember my swim stroke.
Especially you get into any kind of large class type setting, and you're lucky if you get any time with the instructor, the coach, what have you, because there's too many people and they don't have that ability. That's kind of freakish. That is Rain Man-ish.
Well, but it comes from starting at 7 years old, swimming up and down that black line where you have nobody to talk to. So in my case, just being, I'm probably Rain Man-ish, being focused only on what I'm doing. So when I coach a session, I typically don't like to talk to anybody. I usually don't like people coming up to talk to me, although, you know, other than coaches coming to town to visit and we sort of co-coach or they're there to learn from us and I spend as much time as needed with them. But I usually don't like to have people around because I need to be that dedicated and focused. And it's like doing anything else. I mean, if you're really not allowing other thoughts into your mind, then you have the ability to be that pointed in your dedication.
So I have to go off that topic for just a second. We've talked about the fact that you are from Trinidad, but you don't sound like a guy from the Caribbean. I understand you used to have quite a heavy accent and you don't anymore. Can you explain what's happened to that?
Well, I could talk like that if I have to. You want me to talk in Trinidad language? I'll talk in that.
There it is.
Exactly.
They must have a lot of Trinidadians living up by you.
Well, see, you
we
sound,
actually do have quite a few.
Yes, there's quite a strong community here. But when you're talking, you sound like a guy who might be from New York. I was expecting a heavier accent when we got on the line with you and nothing.
Well, it's so funny. When I first moved here, people made fun of me. I don't think they made fun of me. I'm probably so self-conscious. They enjoyed hearing the accent, and it was much heavier and much thicker. So I became completely introverted and just didn't talk at all until I sort of learned the nuances and learned how to speak more like everybody else.
That's another skill. That's good. You've got a great accent.
I want to be respectful of your time here. And like I say, if anyone wants a lot more swimming information, they should go check out your podcast because we could go on for hours. I want to just kind of wrap things up with a bit of a life lesson, if you could give one. You know, look at everything you've done over the years that we haven't even touched about, like owning Swim Magazine, publishing Swimming World and Swimming Technique magazines. You launched one of the biggest swim content websites out there, Ironman Coach, Tower 26 now, coaching Olympians and hopeful Olympians. Like, it seems like a straight rise from the top in the early 80s to now. Do you have a failure that you can think back to that set you up for later success? And how did you get through that?
I can get my wife on the phone. She'll be happy to point at all of them.
We're running out of tape here.
You know, I think along the way, we all make, at least I do, I can talk about be happy, make mistakes. It's whatever you're doing at that time, you're doing the best, at least for me, I'm doing the best I can. And the more you do, and if you're completely dedicated and focused and are willing to always recognize that maybe what you're doing can have a lot of improvement to it. In fact, there's something I talk about with many coaches. The day we think we've made it as a coach, it's our last best day. Meaning, if you think, hey, you know what, I got this down and I have this nailed, it's the last day that you're the best that you can be. So for me, I'm always tinkering and trying to figure out, is there another way to do this? I'm listening to other coaches, reading here and there, always trying to learn, because I know whatever we're doing right now, at least whatever I'm doing, I'm going to look probably pretty silly in 10 years or 20 years or 30 years, well, maybe even tomorrow. So I don't think in terms of failures or successes, but more from the perspective of look at an athlete's season and think, okay, what would have been better for them? And that comes with self-searching, right? Questioning what I'm doing. So I'm always tinkering with our platform a bit. And are those four things I mentioned earlier, improved technique and more volume and right prescription and accountability and so on, are those really the proper four ingredients? So that's a personal quest for my own perfection, trying to be the best that I could be for all the athletes I coach.
Well, and I like that philosophy. It's similar to something that I often heard in journalism when I used to work as a TV reporter, and that we were always told, the day you think you've done the best story ever, you may as well just hang up your microphone and go home and be done. Because if you think that's the best, what are you still striving for? You want to always be reaching for more, and there's always more to learn, and you can always get better. And I think that's, it's across the board.
And you become too dogmatic in approach, because here's the way you got to do it. Well, not so much. I mean, there are people who receive information differently. There's just not one way to do things. And I think, or one pathway. If you go read the 4-minute mile, when Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile, you'll recognize there are four or five guys who could have broken the 4-minute mile on any given day. And they all had four completely different training programs. So if there were only one way to do it, or one proper way to do it, why were these four guys who were doing completely different things all at the same spot at the same time? So it's not that, the moment it's your last best day if you think you've made it. So I tend to try to stay humble and stay within that mindset.
I think that is probably the best thing that's ever been said on this podcast. So we're going to wrap it up here.
We've reached perfection, so we're going to stop.
That's it. We're calling it a day. Thank you, Jerry. Actually, no, I think.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, that's great advice to end on, I think. Where should people check you out?
I guess a couple of places. I mean, we have a basic website, which is tower26.com. We also have a coaching platform, which is coaching.tower26.com. And all the workouts that we do at Tower 26 are available for athletes all over the world. In fact, we have athletes from scores of countries that are on our coaching platform that will do the same workouts we do here at the same time of the year and go through all five stages of progression that we have. We sort of break the triathlon season down into five phases. So that's all available at coaching.tower26.com.
And that entire plan, if I'm not mistaken, it circles around basically the Kona season. Like that Kona is the end of the season, right? So if you're going towards Kona, or if you're following a Northern Hemisphere training plan where July and August are your summer, like you're following that same build no matter where you are in the world. Is that right?
We do that for the purpose of, I think, if you want to have longevity in the sport and not just sort of be a one-hit wonder, you need to have a break in the season somewhere. And I've typically made that the break, where we sort of start taking the psychological recovery phase and the physiological recovery phase at that time. So Kona becomes sort of the end of the season for us. And it's a gradual sort of taper off after Kona. And then we go into full recovery and more technical things. So that would be an end point if you wanted to make a hard set date.
Makes perfect sense. I will link everything in the show notes. And if people want to learn more about you, check out your podcast, check out your website. Yeah, the last few days having looked at it, very good stuff.
Thanks so much, Jerry.
Thank you, guys. Wonderful chatting with you. I really, truly appreciate your time.
Well, I'm sure we'll do it again sometime. I'm sure we could talk on, and there could definitely be a part two.
Well, I'd love to have you come visit sometimes. If you make it here, that would be fantastic to come pay us a visit.
Absolutely.
We'll have to bring back Mambo Jerry. I wrote that down and I was like, I'm going to work it in somehow. Another podcast, though. We'll leave everyone wanting more. Thank you, Jerry.
Well, thank you, guys. Have a great one.
Hey, Trainiacs, I hope you dug that interview. Just a few things before you take off and get onto your next podcast. First off, if you want to get just the best Triathlon Terran stuff filtered for you every week, go to triathlonterran.com/thehits. Enter your email address, and every week, instead of having to sift through all the bad stuff to get to the good, we'll send you out a weekly email with our most popular YouTube video from the previous week, Instagram posts, bought in a podcast, or even some of the favorite gear that I'm trying out. Could be a book, could be some tech, whatever. If you enter your email address, we'll make it easy for you. Get to your best stuff every week by going to triathlonterran.com/thehits.
And next, if you want to support the show at all, you can go to triathlonterran.com and take your pick from a few things we've got there that you can work into your day-to-day training. We've got coaching plans if you are looking for one. We've got our awesome-looking Trainiac gear. And if you click through the Amazon banner ad or click on any of the products that we mention or link to and you purchase anything at one of the affiliate sites like Amazon, it doesn't cost you anything extra, but we get a small commission. And of course, everything adds up and helps us a lot to keep this thing going.
And finally, if you want to get a shout out personally for your family members, tri club, whatever you want, leave a rating for us over on iTunes, good, bad, whatever. And in the next podcast, we'll shout out everyone who in the previous week gave us an iTunes podcast rating. That really helps us get discovered there. And if you want to give a shout out to anyone specifically, share the podcast with someone and CC me in at Taren, T-A-R-E-N, at triathlonterran.com, and send us the message that you want to send to your loved one, friend, family member, most hated nemesis out on the tri course, whatever it is.